Podcast, Rock City.
What's up, everybody? Joe here from Podcast Rock City. Hey, I'm back from Kiss Cruise 4, and I had an awesome time. My friend Bruce and I, we flew out, landed in Miami, got right on the boat. Cheap Trick played. I met a ton of listeners that listened to this show. It was amazing. You guys were so much fun. I met a lot of new people as well. But that's not what I'm going to talk about this show. I wanted to give you guys a little middle of the week thing. My girlfriend Karen was like, hey, you haven't done a show this week. I have to run my 5 miles and I need something to listen to. So I'm going to give you a little treat here. I tape recorded 99.9% of Paul Stanley's Q&A. I missed a snippet, a little teeny snippet of it, but it wasn't like vital to the Q&A, so it's not that big of a deal. But I wanted you guys to, you know, if you weren't there, to have the opportunity to, you know, hear it. It's pretty good. You know, there wasn't a ton of new stuff, and it was a lot about mostly about his book, actually. But it was still cool, and this will be fun. Now, this is a little longer than my normal show. The actual, I think, Q&A was probably about 40 minutes or so, but you don't have to listen to it all at once. I'll put a new show recapping my cruise out probably Sunday or Monday, so you guys, and then we're going to get right back to new stuff, because Vegas, Kiss is in Vegas, and we're going to start looking at the reviews of that, and you know, the stories that I have are awesome. You know, I met Andy, and I met Joe, and Rob. And Rob was my neighbor, and he proposed to his girlfriend on the cruise while hanging out with Gene Simmons. Not a joke. And apparently Gene even handed him the ring, which was amazing. And we'll get into that story. But I made a lot of friends, and you guys are awesome. And I hope you were able to follow me on, you know, while I was posting video on the cruise. I hope you did, because it cost a small fortune. And anyway, so here is Paul Stanley's Q&A from Kiss Cruise 4. Peace.
Mr. Stanley, come on. Who was here for the show last night? Yeah! Pretty good. Tonight's going to be awesome too. You know, at some point we want to talk to you and find out what you want in the Kiss Cruises in the future, because we want to make this better every time we do it. And it's all about you. So we're going to be asking you questions at some point while you're on the ship. We may put out a questionnaire. We want to know how you feel about what we've done so far, and we want to make sure that the next one is that much better. So I love you. You're awesome. You are awesome.
All right.
Where am I sitting?
A nice, comfortable chair for you there.
Boy, I feel like a grown-up.
So, before we get started, Paul, we'll let you know we have some people backstage that want to just share something with you just before we get started. So, yeah, you guys want to come out? Oh, here we go. You just keep eating these up.
Hey, hey.
So, Paul, this is actually Jamie's idea. He had called me to buy a Smash guitar for something, and he told me what it was for. So when he told me, I decided to go in with him on half. It's a little way to thank you for being, being a great boss, the best boss in the world, right? And a great friend, and I'm going to turn over to Jamie so I don't have to say anything else.
Cool. Mr. Stanley.
Oh my God.
On behalf of the KISS Army and Navy here assembled, it is with great humility and a distinct honor to take a few moments to recognize you on this historic occasion. Some 40 years ago, you revolutionized modern music by creating an institution that continues to grow stronger through the years. KISS. But there is so much more that makes the tale all the more impressive. Born in Manhattan and growing up in Queens as the son of German-Jewish immigrants following World War II, you have exemplified the American dream, overcoming challenges and bullying in school. You completed studies at the High School of Music and Art in New York, soon forming a band named Wicked Lester. From there, history was made in 1973 when you completely changed how rock music was performed live. Dedicated to the principle that not all bands are created equal. You created the name that will live in rock history, dubbing your new creation KISS, and personally drawing the logo still used today. Through the power of dreaming big, self-confidence, and perseverance, you pursued that dream to become the most popular band in America and broke the Beatles' attendance records at Japan's Budokan. In the middle years with the makeup gone, you were credited by your longtime bandmate with having been the driving force behind the success, keeping KISS alive. When the original lineup returned, it instantly became the top-drawing concert of the year, with the band's biggest attendance as ever. As recently as this summer, with the current rejuvenated lineup, KISS demonstrated the staying power of the music and the show, your vision from all those years ago. The accolades are tremendous for the band, the biggest gold record award-winning band in American history, second only to your idols, the Beatles. Your list of personal achievements is impressive. Solo artist, movie star, television star, movie soundtrack, dramatic actor. Ambassador for About Face, top 40 hit record producer, Long Island Music Hall of Fame, Classic Rock Award, Showman of the Year, Lifetime Achievement Award from the House Research Institute, star on the Hollywood.
I think we get the point.
Top metal vocalist of all time, top frontman of all time, pro football team owner, restaurateur, most recently Hall of Fame inductee. Acclaimed artist, New York Times best-selling author. Despite all that, perhaps the thing that brings you the most pleasure is your role as devoted husband and father. All in all, not too bad for a young kid from Queens. You summed up how you achieved all this quite succinctly. Quote, "I hold myself to a higher standard than others do," end quote. So, it is with great pleasure that based on all that you have done and continue to do, we now present you an accolade from all the people of these great United States of America. Enshrinement of your trademark showstopper, the stage smash PS1000 Washburn guitar from the finale of Voodoo Fest 2009. In that highest honor for American culture, the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Taking your place alongside memorabilia of American music legends such as John Coltrane, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, The Supremes, Ray Charles, Chuck Berry, and Elvis. And to put it into context, spanning the breadth of American history, from Dorothy's ruby slippers to Thomas Edison's light bulb, Thomas Jefferson's Bible, to Abraham Lincoln's top hat. Thank you for everything you continue to do for us, the KISS Army.
Thank you.
Definitely Mr. Stanley now.
I think I'm just going to go back to my room and look in the mirror. I wasn't trying to write the last in a series of books. Quite honestly, I haven't read the other books. You know, people have pointed out pages or segments in the books, and most of them, you know, aren't that accurate. You know, and nobody, you know, I'm always in a tough position because people don't want me to smash or you know, take pot shots at former members of the band. But that's life, you know. If you tell the truth, some people are going to get smacked in the process. When somebody writes a book of memoirs when they could barely walk at the time, how accurate can it be? When somebody is dealing with substance abuse problems and you know other kinds of problems, how accurate can they write a book when they have to ask other people what they were doing at that time? It's really, you know, that's why attorneys don't like to put people who are problem with, you know, substances on the witness stand. You just don't get an accurate picture. So in terms of people within the band or outside of the band, I've seen a lot of stuff that I just went, it's just not true.
You know, so I want to ask you, like, who knew about your ear? Like, when you were growing up, like, did the band, the crew, I mean, who were you able to keep it from, you know?
Well, when I was growing up, you know, we had short hair. You know, there were no secrets in terms of, you know, your physical look. You know, the terrible thing about having any kind of facial deformity or any kind of difference is you can't ever cover it. And, you know, we all know that if we put on, you wake up one day and you put on some clothes and you make a bad choice, everybody stares at you and you go home and you put something else on. But people with differences, you don't, it's unrelenting. You're always naked, basically, and it's exhausting to have people looking at you all the time. So, really, wasn't until the Beatles came in and music changed that I got a chance to grow my hair. But before that, you know, when you're afraid of people taking pot shots at you, you tend to hit before. So, a lot of people who probably could have been my friends or I could have benefited from the friendships. I never allowed people to get close to me. So any kind of problems you have just kind of snowball. So you reach a point where the initial problem is forgotten, but you keep building up these defenses. So, you know, the quicker you can deal with things, the better. Hey, this is really rock and roll, right?
Well, I was reading the book, and I was like, I started reading the book, and I'm making these notes. I'm like, we can talk about the women, so maybe we'll mix it up. We'll do women, and we'll talk about other things. But I don't know. Do you guys want to be real here and talk about?
But if anybody has questions, I'm interested in answering anything you people want to know. So, and it doesn't have to be in the book. That's really interesting. You know, there's an audio book too, and me too. I did it. It was interesting because the publishers, HarperCollins, asked me, "Do you want to get somebody in to read the book?" And I thought, how could I write a book, design the cover, you know, build this from the ground up, and then have somebody else be my voice? So I did the audio book, which is like 440 something pages. And the interesting thing about reading the book is that anything that somebody might interpret or anything that you might interpret other than the way it was meant becomes very clear when you hear me speak it, you know. So it was really interesting for me to hear back. I didn't want to listen to it at first, and then I put it on and I went, it's pretty good, you know. And I really got into it. I enjoyed hearing it. No, you know, people say to me, was it like cathartic, was it emotional to write the book? I went, it was emotional to live the life, you know. Going through it was the tough part. Telling the story, you know, it's very different when life turns around and when things are on an even keel, when everything turns out the way you worked your ass off and dreamed it would be. Then telling about the tough times really isn't that difficult. It's kind of, you get to celebrate where you are and where you were.
So, I was
thank you.
I was going to ask about Dr. Hilson, if you guys, Dr. Hilson plays a whoa in the book, right? So Dr. Hilson comes into your life at an early age, right? And then, again, you find him when success comes, and then he ends up being the manager at some point.
Well, he was never the manager. You know, what you hear from outside sources is sometimes a bit colored. But, nonetheless, it was very unconventional. I met this guy when I was probably about 15, and really helped me. You know, I needed some guidance, and most of us pattern ourselves on what we see at home. That's usually how we kind of figure out who we are and what we think is normal. My home life wasn't that normal. So I realized that I needed, you know, I needed to learn from the ground up, kind of take some steps back and move forward again under guidance of somebody. So I had no idea what therapy was. I thought you go in and somebody tells you how to live your life, what you should do, what the answers to all your questions are. And it's really nothing like that. It's more talking, and somehow you kind of, it's weird. You kind of rewire your mind, I guess. You just learn a new way to do things, but not by being told. You make the same mistakes, you fall on your face, you make an idiot of yourself, you do all the same things, but it's all a means to an end. So Dr. Hilson came in at that point in my life, and when at some point I stopped going, and then when the band started to take off, I realized that this huge roller coaster was about, you know, I was getting pulled up and going, wow, we're about to start this crazy ride. And, you know, you only have to look around at Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, you know, the list goes on of all the fatalities, the casualties of rock and roll, the casualties of fame. Most of the people who want to become famous do it because there's something missing in them. Anybody who's comfortable in front of a huge crowd is usually pretty uncomfortable in a small group, and it's probably because they have issues and, you know, self-confidence, you know, problems that haven't been addressed. So anyway, when we were about to really hit the big time, I called him up again and said, I think I need something to hold on to, you know, to kind of like be a safety net, a seatbelt. So, you know, I started seeing him again, and, you know, it was not often. I think it was once a week or something like that. Interesting thing is what you hear coming back later on. It's pretty interesting, but it's just not the case, you know. I read that I was on the phone all the time with him, and I couldn't move, and I couldn't tie my shoe unless he told me you can tie your shoe. It's ultimately, when we saw that things were not right with our business manager, there was a lot of discrepancies and a lot of what we'll call irregularities in their handling us. We needed somebody to kind of guide us to attorneys and things like that, and he became the guy to do it. And honestly, he saved our asses, because we were unfortunately in with a lot of people who were supposed to have our best interests at heart and we believed in, and were not doing what they should be doing. So he pretty much blew the whistle on that, and we wound up leaving them. At that point, you know, I don't know how old I was at that point, but we figured he could run the office, you know, oversee the office and keep it going, because we had nobody to do that for us. And we had been screwed by people around us, and we wanted to keep everything close to us. So he really set up a whole different way of doing things for us. The whole idea of selling Kistery direct and printing it ourselves, that was his idea. All that direct marketing stuff, those were his ideas. Seeing the irregularities in the business management, that was him seeing that. So he wasn't, you know, I don't know what Brian Wilson's dealings were with his psychiatrist, but I hear horror stories about that This wasn't like that. You know, it was purely a business relationship that had evolved from something else. And granted, you know, the idea of having somebody who did therapy, like a psychiatrist working for you, is very, very unorthodox. But KISS is very unorthodox. You know, we're a 40-year success story. So we may not do things the normal way, but they got us here. And the people on the outside who scratch their heads can continue to scratch their heads. But I'm here.
So I had a conversation with a guy yesterday in the hallway, and he was telling me that after he read the book, it gave him the courage to go ask some questions to a professional that he had felt were going to be a sign of weakness for him. And reading the book said it just gave, it opened up and it kind of made it okay. What would you tell someone who knows they have some things they want to deal with, but they feel by making that step to a coach or a therapist is
weakness? Hey, we can go through life with a toothache, and it won't kill us, but it'll hamper our lives. Either we get a root canal, which hurts, gotta go digging deep, and then life goes on and it's better. So you get to choose. You are the only one who compromises your life by being a victim. You know, if you roll up your sleeves and get to work, it's not always easy and it's not always without a certain amount of pain, but that's how you get rid of stuff. Life isn't about bearing stuff, it's about getting rid of it, coming to terms with stuff. You know, we don't have to shoulder things that we can, you know, resolve. So if it means talking to somebody else, I think it takes a stronger person to admit that something's not right and go get help than to sit back and ignore it.
Amen. All right. The first part of the book I got to, I was cracking up, you and Gene hitchhiking to find a guitar player.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's incredible. We used to, Gene and I would go hitching upstate to the Catskills looking for this guitar player that he had heard about or knew. And we'd be on the freeway. Gene's wearing like a woman's fur coat. I've got lime green high-heeled boots on. And the two of us are on the side of the road. And invariably, we'd get picked up, you know, and we'd go upstate looking for a guitar player, and we had no place to stay. We just figured things would work out, and we wound up in some crazy situations. We wound up in a commune of people living on a farm who used to pick the eggs in the morning, I think, and so sleeping on the floor. I didn't want to eat the food because it just looked horrible. And during the middle of the night, I'm really, really hungry. So I knew there was still some food in the oven. So I opened it up, and there's a mouse running around in the oven. Then once we couldn't figure out where we were going to stay, and suddenly, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and a van pulls up, and two young women say, "Get in." So we get in, and they drive us up a mountain. Like, if we had to leave that house, we'd freeze to death. We were in the middle of nowhere. And we're laying on the floor, and we're sleeping literally with dogs on the floor. And it was subflooring. They hadn't even put a floor on. And these girls were in their beds. And one of them starts walking around the room naked. And I see Gene. I said, "Gene." I said, "If we're wrong, we're going to be really cold." So, thankfully, he waited. But you know,
till the next morning.
Till the next morning. Until the sun came up. And he got what he wanted. And it was very funny because this girl, not that there's anything funny about hearing loss, because I know about that, but she had a hearing aid. And every time he would get close to her to talk, he would go, "Boo!" We had some great times, you know. It's unbelievable. I mean, we both started out living, you know, we were both living in our parents' houses. And his mom, her her affectionate name for me was the bomb. So, do you have to bring the bum over? I remember they lived on the second floor of a three-story home that they had. They rented out the top and the bottom. And one day I'm calling up to Jean, and she goes, "Stan, we live in a quiet neighborhood." Well, I'm sorry, I live on the other side of the tracks. So it was an interesting relationship. What does she call me now?
Mr. Bomb.
Savior.
Alright, so you go to L.A. So two things about L.A. The first time you came back, you said you asked God not to take it away.
Yeah.
Do you still ask God not to take it away? And why do you think he hasn't?
Yeah, it's when you finally taste success, or when you finally get something or a glimpse of what you're trying to do, then the idea of losing it becomes much more frightening, because you have a glimpse, you have a taste of what it's like. So early on, once we started having some success, once we started having a little bit of money, very little, I mean, we were getting, I think, 85 bucks a week and feeling, very lucky. We could buy things, and we had lots of young women, which made it great, because look, I was a chubby, unpopular kid who chased girls who wanted nothing to do with me, and all of a sudden, the roles were reversed. So as soon as we had just a smidge of success, I found myself literally praying and going, "God, look, now that I know how great this is, don't take it away from me." And maybe that's the incentive you need to work harder to maintain something. You don't get something by chance, and you don't keep it by chance. You get it and you keep it by working your ass off.
Did you think when you were on the sailboat that day that maybe it was going to be going away?
I'm sorry?
The sailboat story? When you got stuck out on the catamaran, sorry. The catamaran off in L.A. I think it was in L.A.? Off the coast of L.A.? The Sears? Hawaii, sorry.
Oh, the catamaran?
The catamaran when you got stuck out
there.
He
read the book.
Just tell that story.
Until the KISS cruise, I never went on a boat again. I was scared shitless. We were in Hawaii, and we were just hanging out. The band was there for a week or two, and one of the guys said, "Come on, let's go out on a catamaran." Now, I don't know if you read this anymore. I used to read it when I was a kid. If you were waiting in the doctor's office, you read Reader's Digest, because it was sitting there. And there was always a story about somebody who was at sea for 3 months eating turtles, on a raft. Oh, and trying to catch seagulls. So I'm thinking, do I really want to get on this catamaran? And the guys are going, "Come on." So I get on the catamaran with our pyrotechnician. Now back then, a pyrotechnician was basically an arsonist. I mean, there wasn't somebody licensed. It was just somebody who liked to blow shit up. So it's him, and I should have known from his nickname. His nickname was Zero. So there's me and Zero and my security guy, who was called the Doberman, and one other guy, and we get on this catamaran and we're heading out, and I'm thinking, this is really not a good idea. And as we're going out, another one is coming in, and they say to us, "Be really careful, the tides are incredible," and we couldn't get back in. So as we're going out, I start to have a panic attack. I'm looking, and the shore is getting further and further away. And I go, "What the hell am I doing?" So I did something really smart. I jumped off the catamaran. I figured, I don't want to be eating turtles, and I don't want to be trying to, catch seagulls. So jumped off the ship and tried to swim in. But being a kid from the city, I didn't realize you have to swim with the shoreline and try to go in diagonally. So I'm fighting the currents trying to go in, and I'm getting nowhere except exhausted. I'm stepping on sea urchins that are going into my feet. And it's just like a nightmare. Finally, I see some surfers. And I say to one of them, hey, you know, I'm having trouble getting in. They go, get the fuck out of here. So I'm watching as I'm beginning to fade because I'm getting exhausted. And meanwhile, my security guy is also in the water with me because after I dove in and I'm here and the catamaran's going that way, I went, don't just stand there, jump in. So he jumped in, so we're both drowning. So at some point, I'm going, wow, everybody on the shore is having a great time. I can see everybody, they're playing, having a great time. I go, I'm dying out here. I'm going to die out here. And life goes on. And it's really interesting when you're in a position where you really see life coming to an end and it doesn't affect anybody else. And you begin to realize just how unimportant you are in the world. But luckily for us, the guy who rents the catamarans on the shore had binoculars. So he came out with a boat, and they hauled us out, and laying on the bottom of the motorboat, and they took us in, and I could barely walk because I had all these sea urchins in my feet. So I get up to my room, and you can try pulling them out, but they're almost like a mineral, like a stone. They're purposely like that, so you can't pull them out. The sea urchin protects itself by embedding these spikes in you, and they don't come out, they just break. So I called down to the front desk, and I say, I stepped on a sea urchin, what do? And he goes, you pee in the sink, and you put your foot in it. I'm thinking, very funny, asshole. As it turned out, 10 minutes later, I'm in the sink with my foot. And it worked. But that was the last time I went on a boat until this. And this is worth it.
When I was reading the book, I got to that part and I'm like, how the hell do they talk him into the cruise? Like, they must, like, it's crazy. Like, I'm glad they did. I'm glad they did. No, I think we are glad they did. Okay, first time Kiss makes money at a show, you each get $13.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first big check? What do you remember the first? What we get? You know, what is it? What, do you remember your first one?
Oh, the first gigs we did. I would rent the truck. I would go to Long Island City, which is an industrial area in New York, and I would rent from a company called Public Service, and I would get anything from a van to basically a mail truck, and in one of them I was basically sitting on boxes, you know. And Gene and I would drive downtown, and we would load up all the gear, and Ace wouldn't lift anything, so help me God, hand on a Bible. And we'd load up the truck and go out and do shows. And after a weekend of doing shows, we split up the money, and I think each one of us took $13. And I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And we actually got paid. So that was... What am I getting here? $13?
13? Well, it's your fourth year, so we're at $20 this year. For
good. Cost of living in
yes. But do you remember the first big check? Go on.
Well, it's all relative. The first big check I got, I think, was Wicked Lester. I think I got a check for $1,000. And I bought my mom, a clothes dryer. Or something like that. So, well, that was a lot of money. Any time for the clothes dryer?
So you can get my laundry done when I come off the road. So the part that I loved was you made the band was recording studio albums, but there was a disconnect. And then someone hears a Uriah Heep album. And the idea to do something live comes up. Can you talk through that? About how that came about?
He's clearly not used to having a mic in front of his face, because he's doing it like this, and I have no idea what he's saying. I'm trying to read his lips, and it's like,
well,
what the fuck is he saying?
He took the book, and he went through the book, and he started writing.
How can I fake it and answer the question when I don't know what he's asking?
This is my first interview. I was surprised that you were
glad you dressed for it. And you all thought you wanted to be me until a minute ago. So the question was, the Uriah Heep album that kind of said influenced
yes.
to do live.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I just wanted to take us to that.
See how easy it is?
This is
so
great.
We had had three albums out, and none of them really sold very well. We were building this great reputation as a live band, and more people were coming to see us live than were buying our albums. Bill O'Coyne, our manager at the time, who was just a genius. I mean, he really, this never would have happened if it wasn't for Bill. That guy, in every way, was the fifth member of the band and sometimes the most important one. So Bill was an incredible, incredible guiding light and source of strength for the band. So he thought, let's do a live album. And I, really, a live one? He goes, yeah. And he showed us this album by a British band called Uriah Heep, who are a terrific, terrific band, by the way. And it was a live album, and this guy, Finn Costello, who was a photographer, had put it together. So we hired him, and we were going to do a live album. So I remember saying to Bill, do you think we'll sell 350,000 copies? And he said, well, let's not have too high expectations. And the album really was, in a sense, a sonic souvenir of what the band was live. Over the years, people would say, oh, you know, you re-recorded stuff and you fixed stuff. And he says, absolutely. We wanted to make the album that sounded exactly the way you remembered, or the people at the shows remembered the show. Up until then, live albums, you never had an idea they were live until a song ended and you heard clapping. We wanted to put somebody in the middle of the audience. So we wanted to make sure that the audience was around them, the applause was around them. We wanted to make sure that the explosions were as big as they should be. You can't really record live an explosion. It does something, it shuts down the microphone. So what you wind up sounds like a firecracker. So what did we do? We took cannons and added those. And when there were mistakes, we fixed them. Who wants to hear a mistake every time you put a song on? We wanted you to hear what you remember hearing. So, to this day, I still think it's probably the greatest live album ever made.
One thing I hear people get confused about all the time is the difference between an engineer and a producer. And I thought you did an amazing job of talking about your experience with Bob Ezrin. And you pointed out that that's when you realize there's engineers and producers and how he...
Funny, those two terms get intertwined so often. For those of you that don't know, a producer in a studio is basically like a director in a film. A producer in the studio is somebody who sits there and makes final decisions, guides things, tries to make a cohesive package. So, over the years, what we found is many times engineers who've been engineers for a while decide suddenly they're producers, and it's just not the case. We've worked with some really fabulous producers like Bob Ezrin, who did The Wall, and he did some really phenomenal, all these great Alice Cooper albums. So Bob was a real producer. He's also a songwriter. To me, if you can't tell me what's wrong with a song and how to fix it, you're not a producer. So we also worked with people who call themselves producers and were not much more than knob twiddlers, which are very important, but it's a far cry from a producer. So, you know, that's probably boring for most of these people.
It comes up a lot. People ask you industry questions, so I thought that was the best I'd seen it. But okay, another story I like. Eric Carr, you guys are overseas, I believe. Eric Carr is getting hit on. Ace.
Oh, this is great. Eric's just joined the band. Eric Carlos was somebody who really gave 110% to the band. He really was very devoted to the band. more committed to the fans than to the band. He really, he appreciated everybody who put him in the position he was in. So Eric was on his first tour, and we were having a lot of fun with him because he was so green. You know, we needed somebody to pick on, lovingly. And, you know, we would be in Europe, and he would ask us how you say, can I have some butter, you know, in French. And we would make up words, and he would ask the waitress, you know, and she'd look at him another time, and he had this thing, he would kind of go, schmuck, you know, after he would do stuff. And we were in one place, and they were giving us these hot plates of food, and they said, hot plate, and just instinctively, just hear, and his eyes just closed, and schmuck. And this went on all the time. I mean, this is God love him. This guy would, when we were in Europe with Bon Jovi, was actually our opening act on that tour. And Eric came down to the bar, and I said, where have you been? He says, oh, I was upstairs with this journalist. And I said, oh, cool. And he goes, yeah, she asked me to take off my clothes, and she would take pictures of me in the tub, but she wouldn't show anybody. And what? He goes, so there are these, literally, it turned up in Sounds or New Music Express, one of those papers, Eric in a bubble bath, naked. I mean, it's just, so, anyway, so, back to the story that we were just talking about, what Andy was talking about. So, we're in a disco in Paris, and Eric goes, there's a guy over there who's hitting on me. I mean, so what? So he goes, you know, and he just keeps looking at me. So Ace, being brilliant, says, let's make out so he'll think you're with me. And that's a true story. What are you guys doing? Great solution, let's make out.
They're all over it. Okay. Did you really tell your mom she wanted to see a picture of your new girlfriend to go buy Penthouse magazine?
Yes.
Okay. The same woman you bought a washer and dryer for?
You know, there was a price of admission to this club for my mom, you know. Hey, honestly, you know, my parents were exposed, no pun intended, to a whole different life, and I enjoyed, in some ways I enjoyed kind of pushing it in their faces, you know, that I wasn't like them and that my life was very different. I remember one time I was talking to my mom and I was trying to remind her of somebody I was seeing, and I said, you know, she's blonde and tall and has big boobs. She goes, all your girlfriends are blonde and tall and have big boobs. So, but yes, she said, are you seeing anybody special? I said, pick up this month's Penthouse.
I love it. Okay, so Evan's born. I know we're moving forward. Evan's born, and you talk about what the role cooking became, that you guys would cook together as a family, and it became this thing, and you had some recipes that you kind of, your go-tos. And it was,
I was frightened. All of a sudden, I'm a single dad, and I've got to cook three meals a day, and I've got to get my son to school, and I have to do homework, and I had to make puppets, all kinds of stuff that I never did before in my life. So it was really boot camp for me, and it was really important for him to eat well. So I started cooking, and he turned out pretty well. He's taller than I am. He's taller, better looking, smarter, you know, so, you know, he and I are, I don't know where he is, maybe he's back there, He's a good one. He's my idol.
So, how did you get a 6-year-old to eat Brussels sprouts? That's what I want to know.
A gun? A clown suit? I don't know. You know, you make them great. And there's a recipe. You don't have to buy the book just for the recipe. But I do Brussels sprouts with, like, cherries and Parmesan cheese and balsamic vinegar and all kinds of stuff. And they're awesome. They're awesome. Even people who hate Brussels sprouts, they still hate them. Take the Brussels sprouts out and eat the rest of it.
The chef read the book, and he's made an attempt to make these Brussels sprouts for us. Good work with Chef Collin. Now, all we had is what he had in the book, so there's a lot unsaid. But maybe you try one. See, give him some feedback. He's open to constructive feedback.
Smells good. Looks good.
Yeah? Oh, here goes, Collin.
I'll take them. Awesome.
Just so you guys know, the chef, those are going to be on the Garden Cafe for dinner tonight. So, so I just have two more questions for you. One is, you're out in public, you're walking around, someone sees you, they're a fan, they want to express it. Can you share ways where you really feel, you really enjoy being engaged by guests? A good way for a fan to engage you in public?
It used to be naked. Them days were over. So, you know, look, I mean, everybody knows what's rude and what's proper and what's not, you know. When somebody comes over to me at dinner and goes, "I know I'm interrupting you," I go, "Wait, you just said I know I'm interrupting you, so why are you interrupting me?" You know, if I'm happy to spend time with anybody at the appropriate time, let me finish my food, and I'm happy to spend time. People come over to me in the market or wherever I am. I never understand when people have issues with that, because, you know, I'm always surprised when somebody comes out of a restaurant and gets pissed off that people are taking photos. Well, if those people weren't taking photos, you couldn't afford to eat there. So, you know, let's be thankful for the people who make us what we are and acknowledge them. So, I mean, that's what KISS has always been about, what we were. I mean, I remember sitting in the audience at the Fillmore East, which was in New York. And at the Fillmore, for $3, $4, or $5, you see three amazing bands. And I saw Jimi Hendrix Experience a couple of times, Zeppelin, Derek and the Dominoes, Humble Pie, you know, everybody would play there. But the thing we wanted to be was the band we never saw. Outside of those exceptions, most bands either looked good and sounded horrible, or sounded great and looked horrible, or just came out on stage with total disrespect for the audience. You know, when you've got somebody on stage who thinks they're doing you a favor by showing up, don't go see them again. You know, I want you to know that every time I step up on stage, I'm thrilled and thankful that anybody is there to see it. And I hope I live up to what you expect.
I just had one more question. This is probably my favorite part of the book, when Evan was born. And you had a quote in here that I think it sounds like it would help for you, but definitely for any dad. I have a couple of kids. So it said, "Up until that day, life never made much sense to me. You showed up on Earth, you spent a little time here, and you died. But as soon as I held Evan and made eye contact, I suddenly got it. We don't really die. We're here on Earth to leave the world better for our children, and through our children we live on." You get me?
You know, I don't know about people here, but life seems so weird, because you pop up on Earth, you live, and then you're gone. And it just didn't make any sense to me until Evan was born. And then, you know, my subsequent children, you know, having Collin and Sarah and Emily, really what we're here to do is to be great parents, and what we're here to do is to leave better children than we were. It's something that's been going on since time began. And when I first saw Evan, all of a sudden I went, I get it. I get it. We don't ever really leave here. We continue on through our children. So it's up to us to make sure that what we leave behind is something better than what we were. So, simple.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, Paul, I think on behalf of everyone, congrats on the book.
Thank you.
Congrats on your life. And thanks for sharing with me.